NPR.
Hey everyone, Cardiff and Stacey here. This is the Indicator from Planet Money. In his recent book titled Capitalism Alone, the economist Branko Milanovic looks at a trend that doesn't get a lot of attention when people discuss rising inequality in the U.S. It's called assortative mating.
Assortative mating means essentially that people who are similar in education or income tend to marry each other. To use the Greek term, which is also used, is homogamy, because gami is, of course, marriage and homo is the same.
Love and romance.
Yeah.
Economist style.
And Greek
words. You
gotta
love it. And Greek words. So this trend, assortative mating, is where both people in a married couple have similar incomes and education. That has really shot up in recent decades, especially for people with very high incomes.
And Branko says the reasons for it are actually good ones, reasons that we can celebrate, like more freedom for people to choose who they marry and more women participating in the labor force and making more money.
The reason why I think it came to be is because essentially, I think it's actually increase in percentage, essentially women who go for university education, ability to actually postpone the year of marriage further than it was in the past. And I think actually preferences between individuals who, you know, find they have much more in common with people who are similar like them.
But this trend also has the effect of increasing income inequality. And the specific way it increases income inequality also has complicated effects on society.
And today on the show, Branko is going to explain what they are.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Chobani Oat, made to taste just like milk. It's creamy, frothy, and great with coffee and cookies. But without the dairy, because it's not milk, it's almost milk. New Chobani Oat.
Support also comes from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. Learn more at google.com/grow.
Branko Milanovic, welcome back to the show. And our topic today is assortative mating. Why don't you just start by explaining what the specific trend has been in the last few decades?
I looked at the percentage of young American males who are aged between 20 and 35 and who are in the top income group in 1970 and ask the question, how many of them, percentage-wise, marry women who are in the same high group versus marrying women from a very low income group? The ratio was about 1-to-1. So that was in 1970. Now, fast forward to today, and actually we have got numbers for about like 7 different years, and every year the ratio increases. In other words, today we have this cohort of the same age, 20 to 35, young American males, marrying 3 times more women who are from the top labor income bracket, 3 times more likely to marry them than women from the bottom income bracket. So that's a very dramatic change. For women, the ratio starts also 1-to-1, ends up with 5-to-1.
Wow. So it's a huge trend towards what I think colloquially people sometimes refer to as power couples,
yeah,
where each side, both sides of the pairing are making a lot of money. They get married. Why does it matter?
It's a kind of a no-brainer, but if you have a rich guy marrying a poor woman and likewise a rich woman marrying a poor guy, these two couples will have the same income. But if you have the opposite situation, rich man and rich woman sort of mating and poor woman and poor man mating, then of course the gap between the two couples is going to be exacerbated by the marriage. It's increasing inequality.
There's also, as you write in the book, a kind of link between increasing assortative mating on the one hand and then the likelihood of making huge investments in children on the other hand, which would seem like it would further entrench the inequality that this has caused.
I think so. It is true that actually when you have, for example, these power couples, many of them work really long hours and they may not have as much time to spend with their children. But I think there is a very strong emphasis in today's United States that actually very educated couples try to find time to spend with their children. And on top of that, they're also able to put them into very good schools when they further, of course, learn things and get an advantage. That advantage basically you get payoff of that advantage when really when you're 25, 28 or later.
There's another nuance that you write about when it comes to this trend, which is the idea that if you have increasingly couples where both the man and the woman, or in the case of gay couples, right, the man and the man, the woman and the woman, have very similar incomes, very similar educational backgrounds, in many cases similar interests, you know, the same, they like maybe the same sports, right, or the same, you know, recreational activities, that might make for stronger, happier couples, and there's nothing inherently wrong with it. But it also does mean that increasingly there might be a difference between those very high income couples at the top and essentially everybody else in society, and that might have some implications.
Yeah, I think it might have some societal implications. If you really were to have a fully 100% assortative mating, that would mean really that essentially class, implicit class borders would be very strongly drawn on a social level, because if you really want to meet only with people who have your interests, who actually have your income level, who can travel maybe to Europe on vacation, you're not going then to mingle with people who don't have similar interests.
Yeah, it also could have some economic implications as well, because if you have increasing sameness of the people at the top, and then they're distinct in many ways from, let's say, the middle class or people who make lower incomes, then it could also affect the support for example, public schooling, for healthcare and how that's funded, and for all these other kinds of things where the upper classes essentially can afford to opt out of, but not everybody else can.
Absolutely. That's actually what is called the social separatism of the rich. For many of the social programs or infrastructure or other things, the rich really, the more they become dissimilar from the rest, the less objectively they have an interest for that. So if, for example, all your kids go to private schools, if you live in a gated community, if you actually go only to the best private, obviously, medical practice. I mean, objectively, the question that you ask, why should I pay for public education? Why should I pay for public health care? Their interest pushes them not to be concerned about the decay of other public institutions.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting theme throughout your book, which is that there are some trends that develop organically rather than by deliberate design. I mean, this is not an issue of rich people kind of twirling their mustaches and concocting evil plans to sap money out of, you know, public schools or anything like that. It's people following their own interests, sometimes following their own passions. There's nothing wrong inherently with falling in love with somebody who's similar to you, marrying that person, yeah, and wanting the best for your kids. It just ends up happening that these trends have all of these other implications that we need to consider, but it's not the product of some kind of evil design.
I think it's absolutely very important to realize that things are not a product of evil design, but a product of self-interest of individuals, which is across the board. There is self-interest of the poor, the middle, rich. Everybody follows their interest. But there is a certain point where you become so different that actually there is no really reason for you to pay for certain things that you don't believe are giving you any benefit.
Franco Milanovic, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It was always a pleasure to be here.
This episode of The Indicator was produced by Darius Rafieyan. It was fact-checked by Maddie Foley. Our editor is Patty Hirsch, and The Indicator is a production of NPR.